Support for KDLG comes from Bill's Tax Service. Bill's first trip to Dillingham will be from February 13th to February 28th at the Bristol Inn, Room 108. Bill can be reached at 907-538-9733.
This is KDLG's Bristol Bay and Beyond for Friday, January 23rd. I'm your host, Dave Benninger. Thanks for joining us. Coming up in the next half hour, we'll get reaction from Bryce Edgemon on Governor Walker's budget speech last night. Pebble CEO Tom Collier explains the lawsuit that has shut down for now the EPA's work in Bristol Bay. And Gabe Dunham helps us recap the week's fishing news. Those stories and more after a look back at some of the week's news. A house fire last Sunday night claimed the home of Elder Nellie Paul in Manicotic, but all in the home escaped mostly unharmed. $3,000 has so far been pledged to a GoFundMe account to help rebuild the home. Bethel's Pete Kaiser is king of the Kuskokwim this year. Kaiser and his team were first across the finish line of the K300 in Bethel early last Sunday morning. He becomes the first local musher to win the K300 in 29 years. The pollock season opened in the Bering Sea Tuesday. The Bering Sea's largest fishery will see a larger catch limit this year. First deliveries are expected next week. This week, Board of Fish Chairman Carl Johnstone resigned his spot after learning Governor Walker would not resubmit his name for appointment on the board, and Roland Maugh was named Johnstone's replacement. Sam Cotton was appointed Commissioner of Fish and Game after serving as the acting. Chris Laddick, the current city manager of Unalaska and former city manager of Dillingham, was tapped by the Walker administration to serve as the head of the Department of Commerce, Community, and Economic Development. Laddick was the Dillingham manager from 1994 to 2001. We have more on those stories at our website, kdlg.org. Well, last night, Governor Bill Walker delivered a State of the Budget address just a night after he delivered a State of the State address in front of the state's lawmakers in Juneau. Walker's sober message to the state was that the finances are in deep trouble and it will take some deep cuts to help make things right. Among those in attendance last evening was District 37 Representative Bryce Edgemon, who joins us now. Bryce, it sounds like the governor is proposing somewhere between 5 and 7% cuts pretty much across the board this year, and what he called deep cuts coming down the road. What's your reaction here this Friday morning to the speech last night?
Well, there's no question that the atmosphere was very somber in that the legislature, many of us who've been through a number of these state of the state and state of the budgets, sat there very attentive, listening to every word, because clearly, we are at sort of the edge of the cliff, fiscally speaking, down here in Juneau, and everybody was has been anxious to hear the governor's budget proposal, which will come to the legislature, and then the legislature will begin building its budget basically off of the governor's proposal.
Now, he referenced that separation of powers, that really this is his proposal and he can manage the executive agencies, but he's coming to the lawmakers for your help to make these big cuts, and that you control the purse strings. You and your colleagues, are you in line with this thinking, or do you think there's going to be some pushback?
Well, there's no question that there will be pushback in some areas. I think there's going to be acceptance in other areas. I'm very pleased, for example, to see the support building for revenue sharing, which under the governor's proposal would be fairly similar to last year's community revenue sharing amount. On the education front, for example, I think there's going to be pushback in terms of any even slight reductions to the education budget. And certainly on the capital budget, we saw the governor's submission last night was very bare bones. I think there'll be some disputing with what projects should go in and what projects shouldn't. So the whole process is now underway. And let me just reiterate or be clear to people that what we saw last night as members of the legislature, we were all walking out of the House chambers, was just a several-page summation of a budget that in its entirety and in its detail is many hundreds of pages. So we have a global view of what the governor is proposing, but we don't have a lot of details at this point. And today, in fact, as we speak, the governor's budget director is addressing the Senate Finance Committee. And then this afternoon, she will come across the fifth floor and address us in the House Finance Committee with more details.
Well, it sounds like we'll have time to follow up with you about this, including next Tuesday here on our call-in show. But Bryce, before we let you go, what else is happening in the state's capital this week since you gaveled in Tuesday afternoon?
Well, we're off to a faster start than we normally are for the first session. The mood here is one of, we need to get to work quickly and start addressing the budget. We've seen some high-profile hearings as well on other issues like marijuana and the governor's mega projects and things of that nature. But still, it's the first week of the session. We're just starting out of the gate. We're just meeting new commissioners, and we're all buckling down and getting ready for what could be a very busy 90 days, what actually will be a very busy 90 days, and maybe even more if the workload demands it.
Sounds like it's also been a little wet down there.
It's been raining every single moment we've been down here. I'm not complaining. I know it's been bitterly cold back home. We'll survive, but it'll be nice to have a day where it's not raining. Let me just put it that way.
Bryce Edgman, representative for District 37, thanks for this update today, and we'll look forward to speaking with you again next week.
You bet, Dave. It's been my pleasure. Thank you.
This is Bristol Bay and Beyond on KDLG. A 3.7 magnitude earthquake was reported north of Dillingham Tuesday, prompting a few residents to wonder if they'd felt it or not. Out in the Aleutians, earthquakes are an almost hourly occurrence, although most are too tiny to feel, and the bigger ones are usually over in just a few seconds. But there's another type of earthquake that runs deeper than those daily events, a slow earthquake. As Annie Ropeek at KUCB in Unalaska reports, that's what scientists are looking for right now.
Obajit Ghosh is a geophysicist at the University of California, Riverside. He says slow earthquakes are deep, drawn-out tremors that can last for weeks, months, or even years.
So it releases that energy, magnitude 7 or 8, however large it is, but over a long period of time, so we don't really feel the ground shaking.
Ghosh wants to know if all that energy is loading up a different part of the fault, maybe precipitating more destructive events like Alaska's 1964 Good Friday quake. To find out, Ghosh worked with the Alaska Volcano Observatory to set up an array of seismometers on Unalaska. He'll install two more this summer, and they'll all run until 2016. Ghosh hopes the array of arrays will shed light on how slow quakes affect the ones we feel.
It seems like they do interact, they do interplay, and the mode of communication might be different in different places. But to be honest, we just started understanding this phenomenon.
The idea of slow quakes only dates back about a decade, but Ghosh says there is evidence that one happened in Japan just before the Fukushima disaster in 2011. The next year, Ghosh saw the telltale tremor of a slow quake under Unalaska while running tests on neighboring Akutan Island.
In Akutan, we were able to record data for 2 months. And in that 2 months, we record tremor activity, a signature of slow earthquakes, almost every day.
That means he can't be sure how long that quake went on. He's hoping for a better picture this summer when he returns to Unalaska to retrieve the first year's worth of seismic data. In Unalaska, I'm Annie Ropeek.
It's our pleasure to have Shannon Spring, the K-12 music teacher at Dillingham City Schools, in the studio with us. Shannon, what was that you were just playing?
That was called Study Number 8.
By?
Sagreras is actually the lesser-known composer's name.
Okay, now, for those of us that aren't musically inclined, there's a different sound to that, and that's because I presume it's classical guitar.
That's correct. This is not country or folk. This is classical music. And it's played on a classical guitar. And the difference between a classical guitar and a regular guitar is a classical guitar has nylon strings. The main difference, not the only difference.
But. All right. And we invited you here to talk a little bit about the Dillingham Arts Council, which we'll get to in a moment. But I want to ask you, many of us had the privilege of seeing the Christmas concerts a while back. And there was a great amount of pride in the progress these kids have made in such a short amount of time, from the young kids on up to the high school concerts. What is it about your job that you enjoy so much?
I guess the best part of my job is watching the kids when they realize they've learned how to do something on a musical instrument. The expression on their face is just sheer joy. And it's, you know, when you can tell that the light bulb has gone on, and it's just one of the most rewarding things about being a teacher in general, not just music.
What about music? Why is it so important that we make sure that it's taught in schools?
The arts, all of them are important. You know, all work and no play makes Jack a dull boy, right? Well, sometimes play is just as important. And music, it's a form of culture that's in every culture. In other words, there's not a culture on the planet that does not have music. It's intrinsic to who we are as human beings. And so to learn how to express yourself musically is almost as basic as learning how to feed yourself, in my opinion.
Several of your students will be performing this weekend. Tell me about some of the students that we may see on stage, those of us that attend.
I have a group of seniors who are going to perform a song together, which is kind of exciting because I've never seen any of my students perform songs together outside of my direction. They've been practicing on their own, and they're all singing and playing instruments. That's kind of an acoustic, folky type of group. And then there's another group of high school students that have a little jazz group together, and they're going to play some jazz songs. And not only is that exciting, but they're going to be improvising. And I've never heard any of my students improvise in a musical setting, so I'm really looking forward to that.
Are you impressed with their talents, their musical ability?
I'm very impressed with their talents. The rate at which these students have been learning how to play is almost unbelievable to me. They just soak it up like sponges, the piano players in the strings class. I hand them a piece of paper, and some of them the next day they can play the song.
We'll plug the Arts Council Coffee House here briefly. I'll say that one thing that I'm always impressed by this event is how many folks come out of the woodwork, in my opinion, in my mind, with amazing abilities, but also clearly something that they are doing on the side. This is a hobby they're doing at home or with their spouse, or they're writing poetry or singing or playing. And I'm fascinated by that. I'm fascinated by how many unique and interesting people are just amongst us all the time that we don't normally see them. So this is a good opportunity to see it. What's important about it to you, this event?
Absolutely, I agree. I was really surprised when I attended my first coffee house, and there were all these performers. Not only had I not heard perform, but I had not even met them in town. So I'm looking forward to hear some new performers. But my favorite thing about it is the sense of community. When, like you said, people come out of the woodwork, it just brings a lot of the arts together.
Can you take us out with another piece?
Sure. This is called Andante by one of my favorite composers, Ferdinando Carulli.
Shannon Spring, music director at Dillingham City Schools, also a member of the Arts Council. Thanks for joining us, and we look forward to hearing more of that Saturday night.
My pleasure. I'm looking forward to it as well.
And we tracked down one of Shannon's students this week. Here, take a listen.
My name is Brian Venua. I'm from Dillingham, Alaska. I'm 17 years old, and that was Rescue Me by Fontella Bass.
The coffee house starts tomorrow at 7 o'clock at the Lutheran Church. Get there early. For the last 2 years, the momentum in the battle over the Pebble Mine has been pretty decidedly in the favor of those who would like to see any possibility of that mine's development squashed forever. The Pebble Partnership lost its moneyed partner, Anglo American. Other major investors divested from Northern Dynasty. The EPA has developed but not finalized 404C restrictions that would block a pebble-sized mine. And state voters adopted an initiative to give the legislature, rather than the executive branch agencies, a final say in whether Pebble or similar mines would be developed. But Pebble, against the ropes, has recently come back swinging. Northern Dynasty just raised $13 million to continue their efforts, and Pebble continues to lobby Congress to tighten the EPA's operating parameters within the Clean Water Act. There is also an EPA Inspector General investigation into agency actions surrounding Bristol Bay, and three lawsuits have been filed in federal court by Pebble against EPA, one of which has now stopped the agency dead in its tracks until a judge hears more of the case. I spoke with Pebble CEO Tom Collier this week by phone. He was in Juneau. We'll pick up that conversation as Collier explains the lawsuit number two, known as the FACA case, which resulted in the preliminary injunction.
FACA stands for the Federal Advisory Committee Act, and it's a federal statute that says that when you're a federal agency and you want to consult with people that are not federal employees, that the only way to do it legally is to set up what's known as a formal Federal Advisory Committee. And the reason the statute says that is that then under the statute, if you comply with it, that Federal Advisory Committee, all the contacts between the agency and that committee will be on the record. They won't be secret contacts. And second, you're required to make sure that that Federal Advisory Committee represents all sides of the issue, so all the stakeholders are at the table, essentially. And what the statute's designed to do is to prevent secret, off-the-record contacts with only one side of an issue while the federal agency is considering some kind of regulatory action. And that's exactly what EPA did here. It had at least 500, we think many, many more, contacts with activists that were against our project, and we think that violates the Federal Advisory Committee.
So the judge, H. Russell Holland, granted this preliminary injunction, which has essentially stopped the EPA for now. Tom, what is Pebble hoping for further down the road in this case?
If the court ultimately determines that the EPA violated the Federal Advisory Committee Act, then under most of the cases out there, the courts have ruled that the agency is not allowed to rely upon the work product of that Federal Advisory Committee, which we're claiming here is the Bristol Bay Watershed Assessment. So if we win this lawsuit on its merits, we think that there is a very high probability that EPA cannot use the Watershed Assessment to justify its veto against Pebble, and they'd have to go back to square one.
Tom, what happened, at least that you know of, after Holland granted this preliminary injunction?
EPA, a couple of days after the court issued its preliminary injunction, filed a motion with the court essentially saying that they wanted the court to clarify its order because they didn't believe that what the judge really was ordering was for EPA to stop all work. They only believed that the court was ordering them to not take the next formal step in the process of vetoing us. And the judge, the very next day, issued a response to that saying that no, he intended for them to stop all work. In other words, put every pencil down and not to do anything else on this preemptive veto until there's been a decision on our FACA case. So we think this is a very substantial victory for us and one that portends that we have a likelihood of being able to stop this veto process permanently.
As part of this case, you submitted hundreds of pages of emails Pebble has obtained, many of them between EPA and outside groups they were working with. You say these emails point to the collusion, you allege. We've posted them online. You've posted them online. You've been around government and the EPA a long time. What in those emails tells you there was something improper going on?
Well, you know, the way we ended up deciding to file this FACA case is that I took all the emails that we'd gotten, all the documents that we'd gotten in response to these Freedom of Information Act requests on a week-long vacation with me. It was a large stack of documents. And spent every afternoon reading them. I read every one of them myself, hundreds and hundreds and hundreds. And what I discovered was two things. First of all, I was shocked by the quantity of contacts. And we've counted over 500, and we believe we have only seen the tip of the iceberg of the documents. I believe there are going to be thousands and thousands of contacts between EPA and activists. But the second thing, the thing that shocked me even more, was the quality of the contacts. In other words, the significance of them. These activists were ghostwriting legal opinions that they were sending to EPA for EPA to use in this process. They were outlining how the watershed assessment should be done before EPA had opened up the process. They knew that petitions had been filed by some of the native groups requesting a veto long before we knew that that had happened. In fact, there's some indication that perhaps EPA was involved in encouraging that those petitions be filed. We've also found that this effort began, we thought it began around 2008. It now appears that there was some work done as early as 2002. And so we've gone back and requested documents from that date. But the significant thing to me, having been in a position in federal government dealing with these kinds of issues on a day-to-day basis myself, in fact supervising them, was that EPA was, some folks at EPA were treating these activists as though they were a member of the EPA team. They were consulting them on every move they made. They were using them to help design both the factual, the scientific, and the legal strategies that were used. And it, frankly, is improper. It violates the absolute intent of the Federal Advisory Committee Act. And I think that's why we got our preliminary injunction.
Tom, it also appears the agency's inspector general is moving forward with its own investigation into EPA activities in Bristol Bay. Is this routine, or do you think this is significant also?
I've worked with IGs in my career a lot in inside government in two different federal agencies and outside government in my law practice in three or four other federal agencies. And I know that inspector generals do not open investigations lightly. They want to make sure that there's something there to investigate. They've got many more requests for investigations and they've got personnel to conduct them. And I also know that they certainly don't convert a preliminary investigation into a comprehensive investigation unless they found something that justifies doing so. That takes a lot of resources to do one of these investigations, and they've now devoted those to this issue. And I fully expect that it will be a very critical report that comes out of the Inspector General. And I hope that that happens here sometime in the next 6 to 9 months.
If EPA maintains the right to veto further down the line in the 404C process,
right.
And they're showing every intent that that's what they would choose to do, whether it's now or then, isn't that an expensive gamble for Pebble to take? Why are you and your investors so intent on spending the money for an EIS if EPA is already signaling they don't want the mine?
Well, because the EIS, because the veto at that point will have to be based on the available scientific record. And instead of this piece of hogwash that they're now relying upon, interestingly, I chose that term. That's actually a term that one of the independent peer reviewers used to characterize the Bristol Bay watershed assessment. But instead of relying upon that document, the one that's not independent, that's the work product of this collusion between activists and EPA, they'll have to rely upon the environmental impact statement as their scientific record. And we think that will be independent, we think it'll be strong, and we think that it won't support a veto. And that's why we're willing to take that gamble.
What do you say to folks who tell you clearly, we don't care how it's shut down, we just want the possibility of the mine shut down? If there's no concern about the process EPA is using, they just want the mine shut down, what do you tell them at this point?
Well, you know, I think there are two very different responses to that. The first one is one I mentioned before. The ends don't justify the means. That's a part of what the Cold War was all about. You know, in America, due process is important. You've got to have a fair opportunity to make your case and to have independent people hear it and resolve it. And I think that that's a fundamental principle of our democracy, and I think it's one that will ultimately prevail here. So that's one response. A second response is, be damn careful what you ask for, because if EPA is able to pervert a process and to avoid due process to bring about a result that you like today, tomorrow they can do it to bring about a result that you don't like. And you know, there's going to be a request at some point by one of the village communities to expand an airfield or to build a power plant or to build a road in the Bristol Bay region, and there's going to be looming over that this unfair decision that you can't develop in Bristol Bay, and that EPA has the authority preemptively, without adequate due process, to say no. And I think that that's going to stop all development in the Bristol Bay region. I think it's going to have a negative impact on development across Alaska.
Tom, here we are at the start of 2015. Do you believe there will be a pebble mine?
Absolutely. We're going to get a permit. We're going to build this mine.
Pebble CEO Tom Collier, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
We'll post more of our Friday conversation with Pebble CEO Tom Collier online at our website, KDLG. This is Bristol Bay and Beyond. Finally, today for an off-season, there has sure been a lot happening in the world of the fishing industry. Our regular guest, Gabe Dunham from the MAP program in Bristol Bay, is back with us. Gabe, thanks so much. It's a busy week in fish-related news.
That it is. Thanks for having me here, Dave.
Let's jump right in with this Board of Fish slash Commissioner. I don't know if it's a controversy, but it certainly happened fast this week that Carl Johnstone, the chairman, stepped down from the board as he was not going to be reappointed, apparently. Governor Walker had made that clear. And Governor Walker's office immediately announced they were putting Roland Maugh in. Now, where did he come from?
Well, that's right. Yeah, Roland Maugh is, first of all, he's got a PhD in forestry, fish, and wildlife. He's the current head of the United Cook Inlet Drift Fishermen's Association. Some are saying that this is a big deal to have another commercial fisherman on the board.
Okay, but Roland Maugh was one of four names that were to be interviewed by the joint meeting of the Boards of Fish and Game to submit to the governor a recommendation for permanent commissioner of Fish and Game. He didn't get interviewed, but now he's on the very board that refused to interview him or declined. Do we know anything about why this happened this way?
Not really, Dave. We know that Roland Maugh was indeed, like you said, one of the individuals that was reviewed by the Board of Fish to possibly be recommended for an interview, but then that final interview list just consisted of Sam Cotton's name.
Okay, so now we have a new commissioner, Sam Cotton, for Fish and Game, and soon to be a new member of the Board of Fish, Roland Maugh, and Carl Johnstone out.
That's right.
Okay. Another big news topic this week has been this potential sale of Icicle Seafoods, a huge fishing kind of conglomerate of sorts, and there's been talk of breaking it into pieces and selling it off to different buyers, or maybe somebody buying it whole. What do we know at this point in the week?
Supposedly the rumor's been out for a while of Icicle's pending sale, but recently recent announcements talk about this idea that you mentioned about breaking up the company and selling it off into pieces. And that might, according to the news sources, be attractive to the sellers because it could really increase the number of buyers that the company is available to. And the reason for that is, for example, some very large companies have
a significant amount of holdings in current fisheries. And if a large company that currently has significant holdings in certain fisheries were to buy Icicle, that would actually put them over the limit of the amount of fish that they had claimed to in that particular industry.
As Icicle Seafoods is a buyer at the Wood River plant here and in Igigik and an office in Naknek, that's an issue we will certainly be watching.
Yeah, definitely. And also consider the fact that they run one or two floating processors here in the Bay each year, too. So they have a significant presence here, and I know I'll be looking at it closely.
Catch us up on what's happening at the national level. Don Young's been keeping folks surprised of his work for protecting our wild product.
Yeah, that's right. Don Young is part of a bipartisan group that's presented a couple of bills. One of them is called the Pegasus Bill, and actually bans genetic engineered fish unless complete environmental impact statements done by both NOAA and the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service find that there would be no adverse impact on the environment. So that's a big deal for genetically engineered fish. The second one that was presented, sort of directed at the FDA, requires that any genetic engineered fish be labeled as such for consumers.
Do we know if these bills have any traction yet? Are they moving forward at all?
Nope.
We don't know.
Not yet.
Then we'll continue to watch, and we'll invite you back to tell us more. Gabe Dunham, the Marine Advisory Program Agent in Bristol Bay, thanks as always.
Thanks a lot, Dave.
That's it for this week's Bristol Bay and Beyond, KDLG's weekly wrap-up news magazine. Send us your feedback and ideas to news@kdlg.org or to me at dave@kdlg.org. Find this week's episode online later today. Thanks for joining us. Stay warm this weekend, and we hope to see you back here next week. What I've been through.